Welcome to Documentary First, an inside look at documentary filmmakers' journeys. I am your host, Christian Taylor, and a documentary filmmaker myself. I'm typically joined by my co-host, Jason Rugg, but unfortunately we had a scheduling conflict today and he's not able to be here. He sends his best and he says he'll be back to join us next week. So don't worry, you fans of Jason, he'll be back. All right, I want to start out by giving a shout out to our recent Documentary First Patreon supporters. Your support is integral to keeping things running around here, and we are so thankful that you're part of our community. So I want to shout out to Adam Sanford and Lida Lyle, Carrie Anderson, Vicki Sullivan, Judith Nolan, Jack Brown, Carlos Cardenas, Charla, and Julie Marie Betcher. It is wonderful that you are part of our community, and we just can't thank you enough. If you're not a Patreon supporter but would love to be part of our community, go to patreon.com/documentaryfirst and check us out. We're a small community, and we see our members as creative collaborators, not just supporters. So come on over. We do Zoom parties and just lots of other little conversations, and we'd love to have you. All right, moving into our exciting interview this week, we are joined by an award-winning editor and a professor at USC, Yvette Amirian. Is that right? Good. Welcome, Yvette. We are so nice and happy to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. I'm happy to be here.
All right. Let me tell everybody about who you are and a little bit about what you've done before we dive in. Most recently, Yvette cut Xmas, an Amazon MGM studio production directed by Jonah Feingold and produced by BuzzFeed Studios. I have to say, I was a little bit nervous about watching it, but when I started, I got into it and I've watched half of it now and I really want to finish it. So I would recommend, even after Christmas, it's okay to watch Xmas just to see Yvette's work. So her editing defined the narrative and emotional impact of the film. She was tasked with editing heavy improv and crafting the funniest scenes as possible. I can't wait to hear about that. She also worked on a much more serious note in a film called It Takes a Village. It's a little short that is critically acclaimed, and it's directed by Ophelia. And how do you say her last name, Yvette?
Martunian.
Harantunian. This film made an impressive debut at the Clermont Ferrand Film Festival, where it secured two major awards. It Takes a Village has qualified for consideration at prestigious events like the Oscars, BAFTAs, and the Canadian Oscars at LA Shorts. It was awarded Best International Film. Canadian Oscars at LA Shorts. It was awarded the Best International Film at that film festival. In addition to editing for scripted and unscripted, she is an adjunct faculty member at her alma mater, USC School of Cinematic Arts. And her passion, this is what I love, is educating future generations of filmmakers. She has received an Eddie Award nomination for her work on Animal Planet's Whale Wars and A&E's documentary series, LA Burning, The Riots, 25 years later, which she produced and edited and was nominated for a Primetime Emmy for Outstanding Documentary Special. She also recently cut Mary J. Blige's My Life for Amazon. So I can't even believe you're here on our podcast. I am just delighted to have someone here with your experience. I am ready to dive in. So you just recently edited Xmas, but you had your roots in documentary film. How did that happen?
Well, thank you. And that was such a kind intro. I appreciate it. So I went to USC for film school, and I didn't have any sense of wanting to cut documentaries. I just knew that I loved editing. It's what I gravitated toward and sort of became known for that within our circle and my peers. And, very quickly after I graduated, I started assisting in narrative, features and shorts and things like that. And I landed on a documentary feature as an assistant editor. And that editor was really wonderful. She has become a mentor to me. She is still one of my very, very dear friends. And I did a lot of additional editing on that film. And so they gave me an additional editor credit, and that sort of caught the eye of the people, who are running that production company, who have also remained really close friends. And they hired me to do editing work on some unscripted series, documentary series that they had. And what was really unique about the projects that they were doing at the time And, you know, this is back in the heyday of, like, you know, there was no streaming. So, you know, everything was cable series and, you know, network series. That was the big things that you were working on. And they had sort of this hybrid style of, it was unscripted, but it felt scripted. And I felt that that fit me really well, because I still got to craft these, you know, moments and tell these stories that felt very cinematic. And I stayed on and off in that world for a long time, and made my way over to a documentary series called Whale Wars for Animal Planet, which was a very, very challenging show, and I loved it. And I'm still very, very close friends with a lot of those editors and, you know, the folks that I got that nomination with for the Eddie Award. That was a group effort, and I was a lead editor on that series for many seasons. And that opened the door to some connections. Some of the producers I was working with on that went on to produce scripted series. And so they kind of took me over with them and convinced me to run post not as a post supervisor, but like a supervising producer in post. So I was more like hiring the editors, overseeing the editorial process, giving notes. And I did that for about 2 years. And then eventually made my way back over to working on Whale Wars as a supervising producer, and also, you know, was a supervising editor on another, you know, unscripted series for Netflix. So I sort of bounced around between producing and editing for a few years there, and realized that I really missed editing and wanted to continue doing it. And my dream was always to cut features, and I got this amazing opportunity to cut a documentary feature for John Singleton that was directed by Eric Parker in 1/9. And that was LA Burning, which was nominated for an Emmy. And I did receive a post-producer credit on it as well. And then I edited the Mary J. Blige documentary for Vanessa Roth and with my co-editor Paris. And that was also a documentary feature. And that was sort of everything leading up to the pandemic. and in the middle of all that, I had a second kid. So that was sort of like a big turning point of realizing, you know, I wanted to be able to work in narrative features. I love doing documentaries. I still love doing documentaries, but it felt to me like that was sort of the next step for me of what I wanted to explore. And I frankly don't think that I would have been able to do that if I hadn't had the experience that I'd had as a documentary editor and filmmaker up until that point, because you learn so much in the process of really building and putting a story together. That's so much of our job. It's not, whereas in narrative storytelling, it's often about kind of creating moments. In documentaries, it's simultaneously that plus literally sometimes creating something out of thin air that doesn't, you know, exist.
Yeah.
As you know. So I'm really grateful that I had that experience leading into the narrative projects that I did. The first sort of, like I said, I had done some narrative TV at that point, but I had an opportunity to cut a beautiful film for Robert Machoyan called The Integrity of Joseph Chambers. And that went on to premiere in competition at Tribeca.
Mm.
And that actually sort of led me to Jonah, you know, because he lives in New York and we kind of connected through that. And then he hired me on Xmas. And so that every job sort of led to the next one in some weird, you know, kind of, you know, way. That's sort of how it is. And then in between that, I did cut two shorts. And one of them was It Takes a Village for Ophelia.
Yeah, it's just listening to you tell all of that. I mean, I have just a myriad of questions, because I have entertained this idea of going from documentary filmmaker to narrative. I have a 10-part documentary series, but nobody's really interested in that. So we've thought about, should we make it, you know, a narrative series? And I thought, gosh, I've never done that before. You know, how do we make that switch? So my question to you is, you know, I feel like in documentary filmmaker, editors are writers, because you are taking this giant puzzle and you may start with an outline of a story, but you're trying to figure out how to write and tell that story with the director. And like you said, narrative is very different, because you're starting with a script and you're figuring out, how can I make this script come to life in a way that is best with what I have. I may have bad takes from actors, or I may be missing this certain thing that I need. So those are the obvious differences between documentary and narrative filmmaking. But can you talk about differences I may not, or our audience may not, understand or know about?
Yeah, I mean, it's this tricky thing, because you'll hear a lot of editors who are trying to make that transition. And by the way, I mean, I've been on documentary series where, like, during the old strike, you know, we had like narrative editors come in and try and work on documentary work, and they had a hard time with it. And I do, I mean, there might be people who disagree with me on this, but I do think, having done both, I think documentaries are harder to edit than narrative projects. Xmas had a lot of challenges because it was comedy and it had a lot of improv, but I think I was good at that because I had this experience, where some of my other narrative projects have kind of come together a lot more seamlessly. Again, it's not to say that those challenges don't exist, but they're different. It's, you know, pacing issues and, you know, does a character story track, and, you know, can I flip flop this with that? And what if I steal this line and put it here? You're doing all of that anyway in documentaries, but you also are, like you said, you're kind of writing it from scratch. I think that's the biggest difference. And it's a little bit difficult to understand if you haven't done it before. But with a documentary, and also, like, documentaries will often take much longer, unless, like, you know, it's for a, you know, if it's for a studio, you know, Mary J. Blige, for example, that was a concert documentary. So we had everything except for the big concert at the end of the movie. We knew that was going to be shot eventually, and we knew it was going to be the standalone thing. But after we kind of got that into the system, it was like, well, do we take this and weave it throughout and make it more of a, you know, something that's woven throughout the film, as opposed to this thing that happens at the end? So oftentimes in documentaries, you'll be like, really close to picture lock. And I've had this happen so many times, both on doc series and doc features. You're close to kind of getting to the finish line and something new happens. They get this interview, or the whistleblower comes and, like, gives you new information, or, you know, you get this new footage that you didn't know existed. And all of a sudden it's like, throw it all up in the air and start over again. And I'm not going to lie, it's very frustrating, especially if you feel like you're kind of close to the finish line. But ultimately, if it's going to make the movie or the project better, you do it. You know, you have to at least experiment with it. So those are some of the challenge, or some of the differences, I guess, that I've seen between the two. I feel like that's happened a little less on the narrative side for me. I mean, I have had projects, like, open up after the fact, you know, if you do an audience screening and they say it's too long or something like that. Yeah, that kind of stuff happens. But having it be dictated by information that's coming in, I don't know about, you know, that hasn't happened as frequently for me.
Right. As things changing. Well, do you have a preference as to what you prefer?
Between the two?
Yeah.
I don't know that I see myself, like, producing narrative projects, but I can definitely see myself producing documentaries or consulting on them. You know, that's something that I'd love to explore in the future. But as an editor, I much prefer doing narrative projects.
Okay.
I do sometimes miss the challenge of editing a documentary, but it's just it's a really kind of mentally exhausting process.
It's a slog. It's a slog.
Yeah. And I mean, never say never, you know, like, but at this point in my life, sort of where I am with my family and knowing what I'd like to get a few more features under my belt, you know, yeah. as an editor.
Well, sure. You're on your way for sure. You know, and I'm just applaud you for having a family and choosing a little balance. I have four boys myself, and I did my film after they were a little older, but yeah. I mean, they're still from 33 down to 22, and I'm talking to them every day about X, Y, or Z, you know? And so I'm still.
That's so impressive. I have two boys as well. So, like, okay. I know to be a boy mom, and mine are also, well, mine are like 8 years apart, but it sounds like yours are like 11 years apart with two more in the middle.
Yes. I had one that was 7 years older than the rest, and then the rest are 2 years apart. But yeah, I can't, it's like the chaos is, quadrupled, and, it's definitely not for the faint of heart, but I loved it.
It's fun. It's definitely definitely worth it. It certainly makes your work more meaningful, I think.
Yeah, it does. And I think it's very difficult to find the work-life balance, I think. And so I applaud you for doing that. I've struggled with that.
I don't know if I'm pulling it off perfectly, but I'm certainly trying.
Good. All right. I want to go back to just your journey from, you know, when you started to now, because we have a lot of first-time filmmakers or, you know, people that want to go into filmmaking and they really just don't know how. And I do find it remarkable that you, you know, started in college and you've been able to have this kind of success. I don't know how old you are, but you seem young, very young to me. And so, so it just seems like it, you've kind of gotten pretty far in a short amount of time. So, and it sounds like it is as in any other business who you know, and it's just one step at a time. Do you have recommendations? You know, a lot of people are debating whether or not they should go to film school and even pay that money. And is it worth it? You know, or should we go to, you know, college and try to get into it some other way? What are your recommendations or like your top three tips for people that are trying, you know, thinking about, do I go to film school or do I not? What do you say?
Well, so, okay. So first of all, without giving away my age, I've been working professionally in this, in the industry for about 20 years. So, in that 20 years, a lot has changed. And so I'll often get my students asking me, well, how do I get that first job? How do I get that first start? And it's a little bit tricky to answer because the way I did it 20 years ago is very different from how it is now. And you know, as you know, this industry goes through phases where, like, you know, a couple of years ago, we all were feeling like this sort of shortage of assistant editors. Like there was just such a need for people to be working, and now it's extremely slow. So that's that variation. It's really hard to predict that. And it's really hard to predict, like, well, you know, how do you get your foot in the door? And I think the number one tip is, like, there is no one way. My story is going to be different from Christian's story or from so-and-so's story. And I don't know that there is, like, one right way. I think the things that get you very far in this industry, in my experience, are relationships. Finding and nurturing and developing those relationships, whether you find that at film school or by volunteering on a set or interning at a production company, like whatever that is, you have to maintain those relationships and maintain them in a genuine way, not like just pick up the phone and email and call someone when you need a job. And I have people in my circle who will do that. And it's a little bit of a turnoff, right? Like, because there's that authenticity doesn't really exist. But the people in my circle who I regularly keep in touch with, I'm friends with, I, you know, like those relationships have really grown. We've worked on multiple projects together. Those are the people that I'm always thinking of, and, you know, hopefully vice versa. So that's the number one piece of advice, I guess. I think the second piece of advice is don't be afraid to reach out to people cold. You just have to be really smart in the way that you do it. So you hear of a movie or a project that you want to work on, you find a contact on it, like, you know, send that email, but it has to be like properly crafted. You have to think about how you're providing value to them. You have to think about what you're asking and are you asking too much? And again, like it goes back to that idea of like, is it a genuine relationship? But don't be afraid to do that. Yeah, the worst thing that's going to happen is someone's going to say no. And that's probably kind of like sidebar, like you have to kind of get used to rejection or, and no in this industry, because you're going to hear it a lot. I mean, you said yourself, you were an actress for a period of time.
You got to make really good friends with rejection and not take it personally.
I think, like, you know, with acting, it's one of those things, like, because we see it showcased so much in film and TV, like, oh, the actor who's always getting rejected. But that's the case for everybody in this industry. Just sort of, you know, it's just part of what we do, or what we have to deal with, because it is a freelance for the creatives, right? If you're like an agent or you're a network executive, studio executive, you know, working in an office, you have a little bit of a different lifestyle than the rest of us. But for those of us who are creative professionals, we're mostly freelance. Right. And so that's like a logistical thing that you have to like think about when choosing this as a career. And I think probably the final piece of advice, I know it all sort of sounds like it's blended in together, but to be kind and just be a good person with everyone you work with, because there can be very difficult personalities and big egos in this industry. And I think, you know, one of the ways in my experience that you stand out, the people who I remember are the people who were kind and pleasant to work with and went out of their way to, like, you know, make my life or the producer's life or whoever, you know, like easier and just figure out how can I help make the project a success. I think that really goes a long way. So I guess that's the answer to the question.
Yeah, that's great advice. So number one, there is no one way in order to get into the business. Number two, what was the second one?
Relationships and reach out to people and build and maintain relationships. And to answer your question of like, is it worth going to film school? I mean, look, I'm somewhat partial. I'm very blessed and very lucky. And by the way, I didn't get in the first time I applied. So I worked very, very hard to get into that film school and to make the most of my time there. And looking back, there's still things I would have done, you know, differently. But you know, you build and maintain those relationships, even if it's not someone that you work with again. Like I have friends now who I cross paths with, they're editors. Like we've never worked together, but there's something really special about knowing you came from the same place. You went through the same program. You were, you know, advised and educated, mentored by the same kind of groups of people. And the biggest thing I think you gain from being at in an environment like that, any film school, not just USC, is relationships. Because it sort of builds the foundation for all of those people. Look, a percentage of those students are not going to go on to be in the industry. That's just, you know, that just is. Either by choice or life circumstances or whatever it might be. But the people who you maintain those relationships with and grow with, whether you find those in film school or whether you find those somewhere else, it doesn't matter. But what film school gives you is this network of people.
Yeah.
And you lean on those networks consistently in your career, whether it's when you're looking for a job or when you need to hire someone on a job. Those are the people that you're thinking about. And hopefully you kind of find, I'll be honest, like, you know, that Ophelia is one of them. Another short filmmaker I worked with, Michael, like there's this kind of group of us now that have become really close. And I didn't find them until much later in my career. Jonah is another great example. Like, I still have really good relationships with the people that I worked with in documentary and TV, but as my career and my life has grown, this kind of group of us have sort of come together where we're all organically, naturally, like we're all friends and we actually hang out. And, you know, that's important to find those groups and those networks, because those are the people that you're going to lean on. And we're not all always like one of the people in that group is she's like a marketing executive, but she'll hire like the cinematographer from that group or the sound person. We all think of each other because we know each other and we genuinely love being around each other all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I second everything that you're saying, because in this industry, you have to be around the people that you are working with a lot. You know, when you are working on a thing, and this is what I think regular people don't really understand about the production world, but when you are working on a project, it is your life. And there are, I mean, it's sad and there do need to be better boundaries, I think, but you are working on these projects intently for short periods of time. And so you're working long days or you're working with a group of people. And if you don't get along with them or don't have those good relationships, it's not a happy thing, you know?
No.
So it is important to find those relationships and collaborators that you love working with.
For sure. Yeah. I think about this a lot because a lot of my close friends and family members are not in the industry and they have these very sort of traditional 9-to-5 jobs or, you know, office jobs. And I think they're close enough with their colleagues, but not as close as I sometimes find I am with mine, because there is this sort of that if anybody's gone to film school, that sort of feeling that you have when you're like this little pocket of just you guys in your own little world, that sort of repeats itself over and over and over again on every production. I had one of my TAs recently, she just graduated. I said, oh, congratulations, you just finished your project. And she was like, yeah, I'm kind of like depressed. I'm kind of sad. And I was like, that's totally normal.
Yeah.
Like you're really bummed after a production's wrapped, but only when it's a good production and all the people are great. And then like this Netflix series that I did, it was a doc series. We've all kept in touch and we're having like a reunion next week because it was a really good experience. We just want to see each other, you know? And that's like the best kinds of productions you can be on. And the way that you build that is kind of identifying who are those good people around you who are not only going to get the job done, but who are going to be pleasant to be around, who are going to be kind to the people beneath them and be able to help people rise up, provide mentorship. All that stuff is really important when you have the opportunity to be the one hiring in those positions.
Yeah, absolutely. I I couldn't agree more. I do think I would add one other thing as I was listening to you talk about, you know, your beginnings at, you know, film school and just kind of how you got into the industry. I think that it takes utter determination. You know, you talked about people, not all people will get a job in the industry. And I think that it really depends honestly on the person, because if you have a desire to do this job in this industry and you just keep working at that and you don't get discouraged and you just keep pushing and pushing, I think that, you know, quality of not quitting is vital to making it in this industry.
100% agree, but I will say you will get discouraged, like undoubtedly, no question. And like, even, I mean, like, I think it's really easy to look at someone's career and go, oh, like they're an overnight success. They weren't doing this 2 years ago and now they're suddenly doing this other thing. Or this person went from doing indie films to being nominated for whatever, you know, like it's really easy to look at that, but you don't know the work that went into it. You don't know how much discouragement and rejection that they had. And you're right. You have to have the type of personality that wants to keep going, because there will come a time where you go, this is not worth it. I don't know what I'm doing. Why am I doing it? I would be shocked if like every single person in this industry who's had that level of success, unless they got really lucky early on in their career.
And lightning struck. Yeah.
Which does happen. But for those of us who have been, you know, working toward whatever that thing is we want to accomplish, like my goal is different from your goal, someone who's a cinematographer or sound designer or whatever, everyone's going to have a different set of things they want to accomplish. But you're right. It is important to keep pushing forward, you know, because it's hard sometimes to look back. A friend of mine reminded me of this. They were like, oh, wow, you did so much in this short period of time. And I was like, did I? It feels like it went really, really slow. But sometimes it takes someone to remind you like, oh, yeah, I actually did a lot of things. Like I really, it feels slow because you're kind of putting one foot in front of the other, but eventually it amounts to this bigger thing.
Yeah. And you're coming right back to, you know, what you said earlier in those times of discouragement, or when you can't really remember what you did in your career, having those people around you that have known you for a really long time, they give you those reality checks. You know, I can think all the time about, you know, what a, you know, untalented, you know, unorganized, you know, all these negative labels I am. And yet I can have a friend say, what are you talking about? Look at what you've accomplished or whatever. And so that those relationships, it goes back to those relationships. And absolutely. Now I want to change the subject and jump into being a woman editor in this world. So editing typically was a male heavy industry or, you know, job in the industry. I want to talk about that difficulty. Has there been any difficulty for you at all being a woman in this world?
Well, if you look back historically, actually, there were quite a few, it was a women driven industry, editing. It wasn't until sort of sound came into the picture that it became a little bit more male driven. And I think, you know, as time has progressed, like, yes, it if you look at it kind of overall, there are, it is certainly, I think a lot of things in this industry obviously are male dominated. But of all the different, you know, crafts, I think at least with editing, I see that there's a lot of women, at least a lot more than there used to be. And especially as, you know, I mean, you know, we're not just talking about features anymore, you know, TV and, you know, streaming and mini series and doc features. Like there's so much more content out there, and it has one of the benefits of it, I guess, despite the fact that there have been, you know, negatives that have come with that. One of the benefits has been that it's opened up a lot of doors for people. I think for me, there have been certain shows where I've certainly like, I've been the only woman, with the exception of maybe like a producer or like an assistant or something like that. But yeah, that has been the case. But as my career has progressed, at least on the TV side, I started to see a little bit of a change. And any opportunity that I have to be able to change that, where the, you know, if somebody's, you know, qualified to be able to take on the job, I absolutely try and open that door for them, because that was also done, for me, like I said, with a female mentor that I had. So yeah, I think I am seeing a change. I think it's slow, but I'm really proud to be a part of it, in any way that I can. I think one of the things, like speaking as a mom, I think it's been more difficult for me as a mom, as opposed to as a woman.
I see.
So that, like, I always say, like, I don't feel like I felt in any way, like I'm not going to hire you because you're a woman. It wasn't that. Like, I never felt that. But when I became a mom, I started to see and feel some of that, even if it was like in these tiny kind of microaggressions and like really small, you know, backhanded comments and things like that. That's sort of difficult.
Do you think it's because there was a question about your availability and time?
Yeah, that's always a big thing. So like a recent project that I had worked on, like they didn't find out that I had a kid until I was in the middle of it. And they genuinely seemed shocked because it was a really intense schedule. Not to say nobody on the production knew that, but it was something that I intentionally like didn't share. And I want to get to the point where I don't have to feel that way. But that's part of the mentality that was set forth to me by the people before me, like, don't tell them you're pregnant. Don't tell them you have a kid in the interview. Like, don't mention that kind of stuff. But you know, as I've become more confident and grown, I also am kind of at a place where I'm like, well, but I want to work with people who understand balance and who understand the value of having a family, even if they don't. And fortunately, I've been able to have that, especially on the last few projects that I've done.
That's awesome. And I want to talk about living in Hollywood. So here I'm in Chicago, and you know, this is the place where people come to cut their teeth and really grow and learn. And then, you know, they often want to move to LA. And so, you know, it's a tough place to live and to work, but it sounds like you've been in this area for a long time. So talk to me about that.
Well, I'm Armenian, and my parents immigrated here before they even met, and they got married here. So I was born here in Glendale, which is a very heavily populated Armenian community. I went to an Armenian school. So I was like born and raised here my whole life. And then I met my husband when we were in high school. And
that's awesome.
And I went to USC and he went to UCLA. So, and we survived that. They're rival schools.
That's awesome.
And then we got married very young and sort of started our lives here. And I actually feel like that's a huge blessing because we were able to, at a very young age, you know, because we were both working a lot and saving, and we were able to buy a house, we were able to kind of like settle and build this life here, where it was important, especially when we had kids. As you know, I don't know what your situation was like, but both of our families are around. And so it wouldn't have made sense to like go to New York or go anywhere else. And the fact that his kind of business was based here and my industry was based here, you know, it just sort of made sense. So for me, it wasn't like, I don't have that experience of having to relocate, but I have seen a lot of friends do it and I know how hard it can be. But I think that what I have seen from the people who have done it, and it kind of goes back to what you were saying, is finding that community to be able to have those people around you, whether it's a partner or a group of friends or family members. Like that's a really important thing, because I don't know that I would have been able to continue to grow my career and be able to have kids without that level of support. And they supported a lot, especially with the first kid. Little, you know how it is. Like, you know, and the more you have, they're like, oh, okay, if I could hire a babysitter. but we're really blessed on that front to be able to have that support. And of course, my husband's been very supportive of my career as well. So
yeah, that's beautiful. Well, I do think I have had friends that have gone here to LA and they know no one, or they may know one or two people. And that is the hardest thing that they report, that being lonely and not really knowing anybody and trying to break into an industry is very difficult. And maybe it's different for actors, because those are the most people that I know. Maybe it's different for actors than it is for editors, let's say. But if someone from the people that you know, if someone was to just show up there and wanted to break in as an editor, how hard would that be?
I mean, I think the first thing that you need, like, you know, outside of like knowing people, is you need to have the skill set. So do you know how to cut on the industry standard platform? Do you know any other nonlinear programs? Do you know how to, you know, as an assistant editor, some of your primary roles are organization and, you know, distributing dailies and managing files and, you know, being very, very organized and, you know, doing sound design? Like, do you have those skills? Like, have you done the work to be able to even be able to reach out to someone and say, hey, I have these skills, I'd like a job, or I'd like to be able to get a post PA position or something like that? I think certainly starting as a production assistant, whether that's in the post department or somewhere, like getting a sense of what it is to be in a production. I mean, you can also go the route of like working at a post house or working at a sound facility or interning at a company. Like anything can really open a door. I interned when I was in college. By the way, yes, I've grown up here my whole life. Not a single soul in my family works in the industry. Like I had no idea what I was doing. They all thought I was crazy. You know, throughout college, I interned at a music video company. I interned at a product placement company. Each and every single one of those experiences, I interned at like this other place too, but the music video company, I got to be on set. And it wasn't until I got to be on set, and it was for music videos, like some of the biggest directors that I just admired them so much. And I was like, gosh, I hate being on set. I really do like editing. So I learned something from that. Mm-hmm. When I was at the product placement company, one of my mentors there really pushed me like, you could be a great producer. You should be really thinking about producing. I was reading scripts. I was understanding how scripts are written. I got to read some amazing, amazing screenplays while I was there that like later went on to be nominated for Oscars and things like that. So it sort of gave me this insight to what, you know, the screenwriting process is like. And so I learned something from each of those experiences. So I wouldn't discount like, if you have the ability to get an internship in some arena that you're like, I don't know, this isn't exactly what I want to do. If that's the only opportunity available to you, take it. You don't know what it's going to lead to. I really have met someone on every project, every job that has led to something else in my journey. And some of those people are no longer working in the industry, but they still opened a lot of, you know, doors for me. So I don't know if that helps answer the question, but the question of, what do you need? Yes, you need some connections, or you need the ability to like, you know, have the guts to like call up and email and look for a job. Yes, there's, you know, there are job portals and things out there. You go to any studio's website, they have internship listed. They have production assistant positions listed. I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, going and working at a studio. Like I have a lot of friends who have gone into creative executive roles that have moved their way up in the studio system. I have a lot of friends who are now working in creative positions, but they started at an agency. You learn so much by being at an agency because all you're doing is covering desks and rolling calls and, you know, all these things that you need to know as an executive assistant if you were to move from an agency to, let's say, a Netflix or something like that. So it's really all about whatever that opportunity is that you can get, like make the most of it. One of the first jobs, like paid jobs that I had was at E! Entertainment, like way back. And I was a production assistant and all I was doing was like logging footage. And I went up, I found the name of the post supervisor and I went up to her and I said, hi, I'm so-and-so. I work in this department. I really want to be editing and assistant editing. If you have any positions, can I please apply? And she said, yes. I was a production assistant for a very short period. I became an assistant editor. The editor dropped out of that show and they needed someone to replace them. And they gave me an opportunity to do it. And I had to fight tooth and nail, like, you have to give me an editor credit. Wow. They didn't pay early, but they gave me the editor credit. And so that was like my first editor credit. So did I want to, not that there's anything wrong with that company, but, and did I want to work there forever? No, that was never my goal, but I saw this opportunity. I have to, and that's not like in my nature, by the way, that was like, I had to work up the courage to email this person and go knock on her door. Like I really, you have to sort of work through some of that. Cause I think editors tend to be very quiet. They don't like networking. They don't like putting themselves out there. We're very introverted, very anxious people, you know? So you have to be able to work through and work past a lot of that, that will get you to that next step. So what I'm trying to say is, have the skills that you need, like take the time to learn the programs, whether that's through a film school or through a trade school or whatever it is, or just going online and taking, gosh, like students and kids now have so much more access to things than we did. Right. You can learn how to edit on some of these programs just by watching tutorials and things, you know, but that's not going to be enough. You have to practice it. Right. You have to actually find short films. Like this is the other thing too, is we're just kind of talking about like, how do I do it where I get paid? And that's important, but there is this totally other world, right? That I didn't take that route myself because I sort of landed in this other world where I started, you know, working. But, you know, who's the group around you? Do you have friends who want to make short films? Do you have friends who are trying to produce something? Do you have a music video you can go and say, hey, I'll cut it for you, or I'll shoot it for you, or whatever it is that you want to do. But it, again, that goes back to finding your people, you know?
Right, right. Well, that's all great advice, truly. And you started talking about programs and, you know, learning what the industry is working in. And I really love your take on this. You know, we edited The Girl Who Wore Freedom in Premiere, and it was a nightmare. And we vowed we would never do that again. And so we started playing around with Avid a little bit, but then have decided we're going to do our next projects in DaVinci. And so because we just see kind of the future of that and all the skills or the tools that we need or want for our documentary work are more readily available there. What are you guys using as far as platforms, and what should people be fluent in?
So I think all three of those programs have a place. They're all really wonderful and valid in their own ways. Most of my projects, actually all of my projects, have been on Avid. Industry standard software, in my experience, and also what we teach at USC, is Avid Media Composer. I've been asked to cut on Premiere maybe twice in my career, and once was for a documentary feature, and I ended up saying no, not just for that reason. There were other issues, like I think the person wanted to be involved in the edit, and it was just, you know, and so I haven't done anything long form on Premiere. I've done shorter stuff, and it's been fine. I haven't cut on Resolve. I finished on Resolve. So I've like dipped into Resolve quite a few times to like, oh, I have to adjust the shot here, or I have to, you know, fix this title card. But I know more and more of my students are certainly sort of moving from Premiere to Resolve as well. So I think any program that is kind of in the conversation, I guess, like, and those three certainly are right now, I think it's important to know them. I think if you're going to invest your time sort of being really well versed in something, particularly when it comes to the organization, the technical things that it can do, how to like temp in visual effects, how to, you know, kind of add music and do sound design and stuff, I certainly would recommend learning Avid for sure. If your goal is to become an assistant editor and work in TV and in movies, I would argue that that's the biggest one that you can use right now. Could that change in the future? Certainly, but I haven't seen it shift in a very significant way.
Okay. So what was the tool that you began with? Because, you know, I've only been in this for a short time. So talk to me, 20 years ago, what were you guys using?
I actually learned on Avid, which is kind of strange. Wow. So I went to a high school that had a media program. Now it's like a full-fledged film program. It was a small private school. And I think one of the parents like owned a post-production company or had like a copy of the software and sort of donated it in lieu of, you know, whatever, to the school. And no one really knew how to use it. Our teacher and one of the students kind of had experimented with it, and I would watch them do it. And a girlfriend of mine and I, we were tasked with one of our media assignments was to make this, I think it was like a short documentary. And we said, well, and we had, oh, and we had Final Cut at the school too.
Oh, right. Final Cut. Yeah.
Which I learned eventually, and I actually grew to really like for some of those projects. But my first like actual experience editing was on Avid. And it was literally like, you know, there's no internet. So we're like opening up the media composer guide and like, you know, how do you do this? And how do you use trim mode? And what does this mean? And what does that mean? And so that was unique for me in that. And there were still like films being shot on film back then. But, you know, it was a tiny little like film program, so it wasn't. It was either that or like videotape to videotape editing. Like those were the things that we were experimenting with. Actually, that was probably my first experience, is like video to video editing, or, you know, like doing audio tapes and things like that. But conceptually, I didn't have an understanding of what editing was until I was able to cut on Avid. And then when I went to USC, they were also even back then working on Avid, but we were also taught to cut on film.
Wow, so really?
Yeah. So I had this sort of weird, like backwards experience.
Yeah.
But what was really cool about that is that Avid is very much built like we would when we would cut on film. And so that felt very natural to me to go back and forth between those two.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I, like I said, when we were just talking earlier, I worked in the Senate radio and television studio. And then we were, particularly in audio, still cutting on tape. And so I remember editing on a Nagra machine with, you know, with a wax pencil and, you know, the tape. And I just, it boggles my mind. But giving that physical, you know, seeing how to do that physically was really helpful for me and in that crossover to digital.
I think it gives you this new appreciation of, like, granted, like, yes, you're cutting on like copies of the film, but there's this, the feel of it and like how precious it is. Like there's a different, I guess, what's the word? Like not understanding, like appreciation and respect for what the craft itself is. And it's, I mean, obviously a lot of that kind of goes out the window as you progress and do things digitally. But since I kind of grew up with that, I have this understanding of that in me. And I say that to a lot of my students is that with cutting on Avid, it sort of forces you to think a little bit more about your choices. And I think that's actually a really good thing.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I want to switch. We're getting close to running out of time, but I want to switch a little bit and talk about actually one of your films. And so that's, it takes a village. And again, this film is, you know, won two major awards. It's an amazing film and it, you know, it's a short, so I don't know that people can see it, right? There's no.
It was for a short time. It was available on Omeletto, which is a short film website. We do have a distributor. I have to talk to Ophelia and see where it can be watched now. I'll have to ask her about that. So Ophelia is actually a documentary filmmaker.
I could tell. That to me felt so much like a documentary. That was what I was going to ask you.
Yeah, we've had a lot of people reach out and just say like, oh, is this a documentary or is it real? Are these people real? So she's a documentary filmmaker. She worked for many years and still does collaborate with Alex Gibney, who's a well-known documentary filmmaker. And she had produced one other beautiful narrative short film that was also shot in Armenia. I'm Armenian. She's Armenian. And that's how I had reached out to her. I had sent her a note saying, hey, two Armenian women filmmakers, and I love this movie. And it was just sort of this natural, like we got to know each other and got to talking. And it turned out that she had been shooting a documentary version of It Takes a Village during prior to the pandemic. And when the pandemic hit, she had to come back home. Home at that time was New York. And she sort of gave up on it because she knew she couldn't go back, but then had this idea of, well, what if I wrote it as a narrative thing? And so she wrote it as a narrative piece, got the funding for it through a variety of, it was a co-production between Armenia, France, and Belgium, went out and shot it, and then reached out to me and said, hey, I'm in Armenia, I'm shooting this thing, would you want to cut it? Sent me the script. And of course, I kind of fell in love with it because it was combining these three things that I'm really proud to be Armenian. It's about women. It's an all-female cast and it's about motherhood. It was like check mark, check mark, check mark, all that I wanted to work on. And I didn't know stylistically what she was going to do because she's not a narrative filmmaker. Even that short film that she did, she was a producer on it. She wasn't, I think she had written it, if I'm not mistaken, but she wasn't a director on it. So this was her first time really directing anything narrative. And her approach to it was so organic. We did a panel recently where she talked about how rather than getting those women together, the actresses together to like do table reads, you know, she had like a wine night. They were all doing like spa masks and just getting to know each other so that by the time they got to set and were reading the lines, it wasn't they're reading the lines. It felt like this group of friends sitting together and chit-chatting and eating cake, you know, and having coffee. And I think that really came through because every single take was like super organic, really hard to choose. The acting was just phenomenal, like really blew my mind how incredible those ladies were.
Totally agree.
I just had so much fun doing it.
Yeah, it was stunning, visually stunning. I thought the acting was incredible. It is all subtitled, which now that I've been working in a dual language film and all of mine are half French, I'm used to reading the subtitles, so it didn't bother me a bit. But I did wonder, I mean, at first I wondered, wow, how difficult was that to edit, you know, because it's all in spoken language.
I speak the language.
And then I was like, oh, when you said you were Armenian, I was like, oh, that makes sense.
But I will say it's a different dialect. I mean, it's the same. It's kind of confusing. So my parents are from Iran and our dialect is a little bit sing-songier than Armenian dialect is, even though it's all Eastern dialect. And then there's a Western dialect which like literally sounds like a different language at times. So there were, you know, ways that they were saying things that were different to how I would say them. But obviously I understand the language and it felt very And I had cut one other Armenian language film prior to this. So it came very naturally to me. And I think it was a concern for all of us, like, is it going to hold with the subtitles? And so, of course, after we had cut it together, we did do a pass with the subtitles and, you know, ran it past audiences and then, you know, showing it to audiences at film festivals and things that started to resonate. So, yeah. And she, like I said, she had done one other Armenian language short as well. So she had that experience in terms of how to write it, how to pace it, all that.
It was great. Super, super story as well. I wanted to ask you also, and then we're going to wrap up after this, but with my editor, after the first one, I did not have my editor involved at all in the beginning processes. That is changing because I realized it is so much more helpful to have an editor on from the beginning to sort of have them in the conversations about what we want it to look like so we know what they need, you know? So, I mean, you know, my editor in the end, like, yells at me because he's like, why did you do this, this, and this? If you'd have talked to me first, we could have done this. And, you know, I think going forward, it's super important to have the editor involved in the beginning, also on set, if that is at all possible. And so I did wonder, was that true for It Takes a Village? Like, were you on set? Were you doing dailies? Or did they just give you all the film later?
No, I mean, they gave me all the film later. Part of that was logistical because they were filming over there and she was going to come back here. And, you know, it was like, it was a whole thing. So there was a little bit of a period, you know, she sent me the hard drive and then I gave it to my assistant. He organized it, gave it to me. And then I started cutting. And that was also the case for one of the other independent features that I had done. I agree with you 100%. I think it's lovely when an editor can be involved from the beginning. And I think that is becoming more commonplace, especially on larger productions that can afford to have people on from the beginning, who can afford to fly them out to set, who can afford to have them involved in like pre-visualization and things like that. All of that is hugely helpful. I think there is some value to being like a fresh set of eyes.
That's true too.
You know, kind of looking at something because you're sort of the first audience looking at it, you know, to see which performances are most authentic, what's the funniest. So I wasn't cutting up to camera or doing it during dailies for that one. I was doing that for Xmas, which even though I wasn't on set was hugely helpful because if there was something that was missing or if I felt like Jonah, you know, needed a line or whatever, I knew what their schedule was. I knew how long they were going to be at the house. I knew how long they were going to be at the guy's apartment. So I was able to get a jump on like, don't forget this. And thankfully I had a great script supervisor who I had a good line of contact with and was able to communicate with them on that stuff too.
Wow, that's great. All right. We are going to go into our segment, DocuView Deja Vu.
Oh, okay.
So this segment is where we ask you to recommend a documentary film. And this can be a documentary that you have done yourself, or it can be one you've seen recently that you're really jazzed about. But we want to share new films with our audience. So
great question. Okay, I have two. Can I recommend two?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I only recommend these two because when I do my documentary lecture in my class, I'll often try to expose the kids to something new that they haven't seen yet. But these are like the two that I kind of consistently go back to. One of them I have absolutely no connection to. One of them I have a personal connection to because I know the director. So the one that I have no connection to was a film called Three Identical Strangers.
I love that film.
I love this film because, you know, some of the more traditional things that you see in a documentary, like voiceover and, you know,
talking heads.
It has talking heads, but when you look at it, like structurally, literally the entire movie is talking heads on a screen.
Yeah.
Creations that are done in a very creative way.
Yeah.
And archival footage that's repurposed in very, very different ways and a little bit of verite that comes toward the end. Right. So, you know, it kind of employs these traditional techniques, but it does it in a really unique way. I think the pace is really beautiful. I think the use of music is just so cool. I love the way that they repurpose the archival footage. And it's just one of these documentaries that when I watch it structurally, like I'm always struck by how did they structurally craft this? And did they know, were they going to use the archival footage in the way that they did? Anyway, so that's one of my favorites that I always kind of go to. And then the second one is a documentary short that was shortlisted for the Oscar in 2017, I want to say. It's a filmmaker named Narya Mukherjee Chan, also an Armenian filmmaker. Sorry, I'm very, very proud to be Armenian. But she had asked me to cut it, and schedule wise, I couldn't do it. So I've like really kind of, she knows this is like one of my biggest regrets in my career. Cause I think it turned out to be a beautiful film, but undoubtedly that's because of her work with her editor and her vision on this. But it's a documentary short. It's about 40 minutes long, and it's about a Turkish woman who finds out she has Armenian roots and how that sort of evolves and the inner sort of turmoil and struggles that come with that. And, you know, Nara did this beautiful job documenting it while sort of keeping a distance, but adding her own personal elements to it. And I just thought it was like really lovely in the way that it was crafted. Not a lot of people have heard of it. It's called The Other Side of Home. And I think it's available to watch. I think Three Identical Strangers is on Hulu, if I'm not mistaken. And Other Side of Home, there's this great website called Canopy, K-N-O-P-Y, that has a lot of really cool independent and some mainstream films as well. And I think The Other Side of Home is on it.
So Canopy is an educational software or an educational platform. Can people outside the educational system access Canopy?
That's a good question. I don't know. I remember having to set up a login, but I don't remember if it was through USC or if I did it on my own. I would imagine there might be some like service or you can like pay or something like that. Yeah. Or if you're an educator or if you're a student.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been wonderful. You are just full of information. Your career to me is just so impressive, and just your vast knowledge of all of those, you know, experiences, particularly that you have narrative and doc and TV work, just incredibly impressive. So thank you so much for your time today and sharing your wisdom and your knowledge. I know our audience is really going to appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right, everybody, we're going to wrap it up. We really appreciate you listening. You have been listening to Documentary First, where we believe everybody has a story to tell and you can be the one to tell it. Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Documentary First. We really appreciate your partnership with us. We can't do any of this without you. So thank you for listening, donating, and following along on our journey. We are supported by generous donations from people just like you. To make a donation, visit thegirlwhowarefreedom.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/documentaryfirst. To learn more about our other works in progress, visit documentaryfirst.com or follow Documentary First on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Documentary First, edited and mixed by Jason Hoban, with music by Jeff Kurtenacker.